afternoon or good evening, depending on where you are in the world, and welcome to Information Week Live for the week of August 23rd, 2015. I'm Kurt Franklin, Executive Editor of Information Week, and your host for this episode. I'm joined today by a great panel. We've got one of Information Week's other executive editors, executive editor for community and all things entertaining in the world of IT, Dave Wagner. Dave, welcome to Information Week Live.
Hi, Kurt. Thanks.
And a top Information Week contributor, Larry Loeb, joins us today. Larry, welcome to Information Week Live.
Thank you, Kurt. This one's for Marta.
As well it should be. Now, Larry is referring to one of the regular members of our Information Week Live community. And for everyone who is joining us via on demand, we're glad to have you in the audience. But you should know that every Friday at 3 p.m. Eastern, Information Week Live is, in fact, live. And we have a great conversation that goes on around the on-air discussion. We would love to have your voice in that online conversation, so make plans to join us. As I said, every Friday at 3 p.m., we're right here for Information Week Live. Now, we've got a lot to talk about this week, although I'm pleased, I think, to say that it seems like this has been a week without a major data disaster. So that leads to the obvious question of what on earth we found to hold our interest during the week. And Larry, I'm going to turn to you first. What was out there that just grabbed you and said, this is why you're excited to be knowing everything you can about the IT industry this week?
Well, Ashley Madison, of course. We've been having a long discussion based on a couple of articles I wrote on a couple of aspects of this whole thing. Not so much the salaciousness, because I'm sure Extra and Hollywood Tonight will be happy to cover that, but more on the order of what in the world do you do when a public hack hits you? That's a real IT problem. And the Ashley Madison exploit is in many ways a canary in the cage for all IT managers. You have to have the playbook down when something goes really wrong and publicly wrong.
Well,
don't you think?
I would think so. And, you know, I would fall back to something many years ago. I worked for a company that ended up buying some airplanes to use in a charter service. And before the paint job was dry with the new colors, we had to have an incident response plan put together. So that in the event that any number of things happened, from severe weather delays all the way down to one of the planes falling out of the air, there was a playbook in place. So we knew who got called first, what the first people in front of the press would say. These were thick volumes of information on how we would respond. And in this day and age, it seems unusual that there would be any company dealing with public information that doesn't have something like that ready to go.
Have you seen the pictures of the CEO of Ashley Madison? He looks like Leisure Suit Larry.
Sounds like just the person to give you great confidence in what's going on up there. Now, Dave, I know that you live, out there in the wilds of the West Coast. Is this the kind of thing that is just passing by without anyone noticing it out there, or are people talking about Ashley Madison even out on the West Coast?
Well, I think mostly we've turned to whose data was breached and who's not on a social level. One thing I'd like to, though, add to what you guys are saying about having a plan is let's remember that a plan is great until it actually meets the enemy, right? We saw this with, to take your airline example, Kurt, we saw this with the Malaysia airline disappearance where we had no idea where the plane even was. All of a sudden, whatever plan you had for what happens when one of your planes falls out of the sky disappears when we don't even know where the plane fell out of the sky, right? And in a certain way, Ashley Madison may or may not have had a plan, I don't know. But that plan changes drastically with whether it's a hacktivist trying to blackmail you out of business or whether it's somebody who just has a couple of Social Security numbers. Sometimes you can plan for a lot of things and you can't plan for them all. So one of the things I think is also important is to not only have a plan, but to have somebody who's a little more improvisationally aware than it seems like some of these companies are. And that may be a new talent for CIOs when we're recruiting that we hadn't thought about even just a couple of years ago.
Well, and now here's an interesting question, and I think it's one worth considering. Once the news, you know, the Ashley Madison incident kind of happened in slow motion because we had the announcement of the breach that came from the hacker or hackers, and they said that if Ashley Madison didn't shut down by a particular date, then the information would be released. So there was that gap where, you know, this digital sword of Damocles was hanging over Ashley Madison and all their users. You would think that in that time they would have been able to formulate some sort of rock-solid response. The question is, though, during that time, was the chief responsibility for a response in the hands of the CIO or the chief marketing officer, the chief communications officer? It seems to me really that once the breach has occurred, in many ways this becomes an entire organization's problem rather than just the IT group's problem.
Fair enough. Though I think the most important step in this response process is always what is actually happening, what is real and what isn't, what did the hackers really get compared to what they're claiming they got, et cetera, et cetera. And what is really happening in a tech breach still falls on the CIO.
Well,
CIO for this organization may have been the 25-year-old they have running the Twitter accounts.
Yes, and that's the problem with the way startups are growing these days, right? You can form a multi-million-dollar company in your garage again, which is a good thing, right? That leads to a lot of innovation, but it also leads to vulnerabilities because you're a big company facing big problems, but you're still a small staff with a good idea.
Well, now, I have to tell you, one of the things that I found most surreal about this week, in a week that, you know, let's face it, much of what was going on around Ashley Madison was at best surreal. But I think the high water point for me was when we had John McPhee, former security expert or antivirus expert, former Costa Rican fugitive, doing serious analysis of the Ashley Madison breach and saying that through that analysis he knew precisely who had done it.
Because he's a social engineer.
That's right. To me, that was really the high water point in terms of just sheer weirdness. I'm not hearing disagreement from the panel.
No, it's reminiscent of like a second gunman theory, or you know, the fantastic thing about making those sorts of statements is we're seeing Donald Trump do in our presidential election, is you can make a lot of statements like that and never have anybody call your bluff.
That's true. That's very true.
But I happen to think, he said, McAfee may have some very real analysis going on. His rationale was basically, well, I'm an expert, trust me. But when you actually read what he was saying and why he was saying what he was saying, it did not seem totally implausible.
Well, I will admit that there was at the very least a logical consistency to everything he said. It was not a scattershot. I don't know that it's correct, but it's certainly logically consistent.
And maybe the meds had taken hold for a day or something.
Yeah, but another thing that has logical consistency that was in the news this week is the new Jon Snow twin theory in Game of Thrones. So sometimes something can make the news, have all the consistency in the world, and mean absolutely nothing in reality.
Well, now
I've heard Jon Snow is dead.
Speaking of winter coming,
yes, we'll have a Game of Thrones episode another week.
Well, you know, when we're talking about winter coming, I've got to say that there was a story that came out this week, and Dave, I think you were on top of this one, that in the heavily populated crime center of North Dakota, we are going to have the first domestic use of weaponized drones. What on earth are the folks in North Dakota thinking?
Yeah, well, perhaps the most interesting part of this story is how we got to where we got. So a bill was put forth in the North Dakota State Assembly that was originally written to deny all weapons on drones by use of the government, by use of anybody. No weapons on drones. Sounded really reasonable. Somewhere in the process, a lobbying group entered the fray and, in fact, somehow got the bill to do the exact opposite, which is that it has now permitted North Dakota police to put non-lethal weapons on drones, non-lethal being things like tasers, beanbag cannons, rubber bullet machine guns, those sorts of things. The first thing to point out here is none of these weapons are actually non-lethal. Last year alone, there were 39 deaths by taser attack in the United States. The same thing is true of all of these weapons. There are tragic accidents that occur. But that aside, the really frightening thing about this from my point of view, regardless of what you think about the police, and I'm not in any way trying to get down on the police, what we're seeing with drone usage in the Air Force is that these are people who are highly overused, going through amazing stress, quitting in larger numbers than they're being able to be recruited. And the reason is that the job itself of flying a drone for 8 to 12 hours a day, looking through that camera and trying to make crucial decisions a few times a day, 12 hours a day, is actually driving people to all sorts of stress and sometimes actual post-traumatic stress disorder. So asking people in a police setting to do the same thing sounds a little frightening to me.
You know, I have to agree with that. And again, I have friends who are law enforcement officers, so I don't have a blanket condemnation of our law enforcement officers at all. But with that said, this is the answer to a question that no one outside of that lobbying group had ever really thought to ask. And it must be stated that for some of these, I mean, think about a beanbag weapon. The sheer physics involved in getting a beanbag launched out there with enough velocity to be noticed means you're going to have a pretty darn big drone. These aren't the little hobbyist DJIs we're talking about. These are pretty substantial flying platforms.
Exactly. Yeah, the thing that shocked me when I did research on this, my initial reaction was positive to this, by the way. My initial reaction was that the hardest thing that a police officer has to do in the line of duty is make the decision whether to shoot or not. Right, that's a horrible decision, right? Regardless of how you feel about what's been happening in this country, policemen and policewomen asked to make that decision are being asked to do something nearly impossible, right? It's that person reaching for a wallet or a gun, right? And so my thought was taking that decision out of the hands of somebody in the middle of stress, in the middle of fear for their lives, was a good idea. The idea that you're safe in your drone piloting room, your control center, allows you to make a more dispassionate decision about whether the person in front of you is a threat or not a threat. And that was my initial reaction, that I thought this was going to help with some of the more recent police decisions we've seen made poorly. But ultimately, what I've seen instead is that the pilots who've been asked to make those same decisions in war zones are saying that decision is harder, it's more stressful, it's more difficult, and it wears on them. So that they're not the person who makes that first decision is not the same person who makes the tenth.
Dave, I don't know if you researched this, but the first thing that comes to my mind is that I'm going to hijack that drone.
Right.
I'm going to set off the damn weapons whenever I want.
Right. Well, and that's clearly there's always a threat to that. But we've also seen that now police cruisers can be jacked. So, I'm not sure adding another way in which something can be hacked matters that much to the 21st century security reality. The other interesting part about this is that a person in Connecticut recently was the first person to put an operating, working handgun on a drone. And it was determined that he broke no laws because there are no laws against this. So the drones that the police are operating in North Dakota with tasers may actually be outgunned by civilian drones in the near future. So we may have gunfights in the air between drones, civilian drones, and police drones. And so I compared it much to the early 20th century confluence of the machine gun and the automobile at the same time, changing the way gangsters rob the banks. We might actually be seeing the weaponized drone arms race between civilian criminals and the police.
Oh, joy. I think that's just the best. It makes you want to run right out and sign up for Ashley Madison. It does.
Bringing this around for one interesting factoid, out of the 35 million accounts, they've determined 30 million were male-oriented, five and a half were female-oriented, and there are only about 10 to 12K active females on the site. So, the male employees of Ashley Madison, as one of our conversationalists note, may be the ones who are actually involved in it.
You know, I'm not even sure where to go with a comment on that. I had seen that statistic, and I acknowledge that the statistic is out there, and I won't even argue about its accuracy. I have no clue what kind of bucket to put that information in. Part of that right. is probably due to a combination of my age and my essentially boring nature. But I got nothing.
Yeah, I'm telling you, to that information.
It's Leisure Suit Larry here.
My response to that information was that it's fine as long as you don't pay attention to what's behind the curtain. It's just like the Wizard of Oz, right? What you don't know won't hurt you. It's only when you find out that the wizard is behind the curtain talking into a machine that it suddenly becomes a problem.
Well, now, to segue from that into a slightly less entertaining area, you know, you were talking about the veracity of information, and that's an area that the Federal Trade Commission often gets involved in. But this week, a court case came along in which it was allowed that the FTC can be the government body that regulates online security, at least from the standpoint of a company and the security of its customers' data. Now, this was in response to a breach at Wyndham Hotels. And I have to say, I'm going to use the comment from a peer at another publication who said that in this case, Wyndham didn't have bad security. They had no security, zero security for their customer information. And the FTC said, you know what? That's something we can deal with. So my question to my fellow panelists is this a good thing, or is this the beginning of the end of us doing any sort of commerce online?
Well, you've really got to realize, Kurt, that this is an extension of FTC policy in the commercial area only. One of the stories I almost wrote but didn't was about the new security rules that will affect military contractors, that they have to report any breaches within 72 hours, for instance. That kind of exact reportage requirements is not built into the FTC oversight. My understanding of what went on was that they felt that Wyndham had actually committed a commerce by not asserting the security of their paid-for networks. And that's a bit different than just thinking that the FTC is going to do a massive turf grab here. They may do a turf grab when money changes hands for a service, but it's not going to be the entire cybersecurity package.
Well, that does sound like it's much more limited and therefore, I think, much more defendable. Dave, what are your thoughts on this one?
Even if it wasn't, even if it were a giant turf grab, I have to say at this point, nobody else has been doing the job. Not in the government, not in enterprises, not anywhere. No one is doing a good job with security, and you can argue that it's impossible, that it's an impossible task, and I'd be willing to agree that there will always be breaches and such. But if Wyndham has no security, that's something that stockholders need to know. It's something that that people who get a room at a Wyndham need to know. It is not an acceptable thing. So if somebody steps forward and creates a minimum level of security best practices that are actually kept, and they do some small amount of justice out of that, I'm actually going to be all for that. And you know, I'm sure some of how you feel about that depends on your politics, your trust in government, all of that kind of thing. But it's become clear and obvious to me that we can no longer trust enterprises to just assume they're going to have at least a minimum level of security.
Well, while it's, you know, I think you're exactly right. We can't trust the companies to have even minimal security. I guess my question is, if we all know that we shouldn't be trusting the companies, then are there advantages to having the government step in to enforce something that no one assumes exists?
Well, we would like it to exist on a certain level, right? Now, I there's no way we're ever going to get to a point where everything is fully secure. I'm aware of that. But there's a difference between it is not ever 100% guaranteed, and it is 100% guaranteed that this will be breached. And somewhere in the middle seems to be a place where I'm guessing consumers and people deserve to be. I think we can all agree. It's like saying we don't need the EPA to do anything about nuclear plants anymore because we know eventually one of them's going to melt down. Well, just because one of them's eventually going to melt down doesn't mean we don't regulate the thing, right?
Yeah, but again, this whole FTC thing seems to me a far more limited consumer-oriented commercial kind of arrangement.
The real who needs to be protected
within some ways, perhaps, but the FTC does not have a team of cybersecurity experts. I read the ruling in this case. It was very, very procedural. It looked at the fact that Wyndham said, well, there were no regulations published, and all sorts of legal arguments on that sort of level. And it was decided that just because there was no exact regulation that applied to Wyndham, there was sort of an underlying situation that should have applied to Wyndham. So I'm not getting all excited about this as being a great big trend.
No.
I think in this case, it was decided that this case is the way it goes down.
Right. No, I don't disagree with what you're saying, but the issue is, to my knowledge, the Wyndham saying there's no regulation really bothers me, because for the last several years of my covering breaches professionally, underlying every discussion about breaches was the idea that CEOs would eventually say, the cost of a breach and the danger to my business outweighs these other things, so we need to have security. The truth is, CEOs are making the opposite decision. They're saying there are so many breaches that the cost of these breaches is no longer higher than the cost of security to be 100% secure. And sometimes they're wrong about that. Sometimes they're making bad monetary decisions. But CEOs are making choices not to secure their companies and in the process ensuring consumer protection. And somebody's got to step in and do that. And I don't care if it's the FTC or who, but that to me, we're coming to the point where we can no longer believe that the economy alone, that the free market alone, is going to encourage more security investment.
Well, I've got to disagree on the methods here. The analogy you're using is similar to what GM said about replacing the ignition switches in its models. The costs outweigh the benefits. Somebody whose information is misused while using somebody's services may get this honker of a class action suit out there and just womp these guys. That may be economic rationale to increase security right there.
Well, we haven't seen it. I mean, Target, in my mind, when they had their breach, paid a pittance in a class action suit and a fine for what they went through. I just don't see anybody demonstrating to me that a class action suit or a loss in customers or any of these fears that CIOs have on security are creating an economic incentive to do better with security. They talk it. I hear them say it every time I go to a conference. But then another breach comes, and then another CEO has to admit that they didn't do anything.
Well, it sounds like this is the sort of thing that we're going to be talking about for a while into the future, because I have trouble believing this is the last time the FTC and a company are going to end up in court talking about this issue. Something tells me that this is the first of these cases and not nearly the last. But before we get away for today, I think it's time to take the advice of a famous 70s comedian, and let's get small. Let's get very small, as a matter of fact. Dave, in the geek end, you're talking about teeny tiny little fishies. What's going on with these microfish?
Yeah, the University of California at San Diego has created the first 3D printed micro robots, meaning microscopic, meaning thinner than a human hair, about half the width of a human hair, 3D printed microscopic robots that are made of more than one material. In this case, they happen to be in the shape of fish. And the reason for that is that these tiny robots can propel themselves using hydrogen peroxide as a chemical fuel to swim through your bloodstream and either take out toxins or deliver medicine. And this is an amazing step forward. Previous microbots and nanobots that have been invented have difficulty moving over distances. Part of it is because of their shape. Part of it is because we haven't been able to create a good propellant system. These fish can do those things. And now, why is that exciting? Well, it's exciting because we have a general belief that cancer, Parkinson's disease, Alzheimer's disease, Hep C, several other diseases would best be treated internally, would best be treated if we could get inside on a very small microscopic basis and directly deliver drugs to that spot. And earlier this year, in January, UC San Diego became the first university to deliver a drug through a nanobot into a human being. So if you combine these two pieces of knowledge, how to create a nanobot, or a microbot in this case, that can move through a human bloodstream, and combine it with how to deliver a medical payload in a nanobot, we may have created the delivery mechanism for medicines we never could have had before.
Well, now,
this sounds like Fantastic Voyage.
Yes, yes, it does. It also sounds like the plot of an old Disney ride that they have gotten rid of called Body Wars. but yes, you're right. This is something that's been envisioned for a long time. And it goes back probably centuries, but very much in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, this was a vision of how we could treat the human body.
Well, now, as someone who has spent a non-trivial amount of time taking medications, the idea of being able to have something that goes right to the point where it's needed rather than flooding the whole body with chemicals seems like a good thing. Are they talking about horrible downsides to this? I mean, might all of the fish get together and decide to swim upstream at once and cause a problem before they lay their tiny little nano eggs and die?
Well, so right now, the people who are talking about this really, obviously, they're working on it. They don't see a downside, right? They have worked through those things. But the general perception of nanobots or microbots in society has been that they're bad news. And the reason for that is the gray goo theory that I believe came out in the 1980s, that we would one day create a self-replicating nanobot, and that nanobot would multiply so fast like a bacteria that we couldn't stop it, and it would devour all organic life on the planet in an attempt to self-replicate. That eventually the planet would just be this gray goo, this mass of metal objects. Generally, that theory has been debunked, mostly from the point of view that that would require so much heat that if any nanobot started doing it, we would discover it so soon that we could destroy them all with a simple electronic pulse. There are other theories about how this could be stopped. But yes, one of the general problems that we have in society is that the idea that we're going to inject things into the body that have been made by people and programmed by people might go haywire inside our body is a fear that's not going to go away anytime soon.
Well, now, Larry, I know that you have both an engineering and a professional background in things that happen in and around the body. Is this something that you're exceptionally worried about, or do you see this as a promising development?
It depends on the guidance and control systems. To answer your upstream question, I don't know enough about these particular bots to understand how the motion is controlled. There's got to be something in there to overcome Brownian motion in the bloodstream. I mean, there's just a whole bunch of things bouncing around each other. To get around that, to be able to deliver whatever they deliver to wherever they need to deliver it, maybe there's a drone pilot for these fishes envisioned. I don't know. Maybe you just put a magnet on top of where you want them to be and they follow the magnetic field.
Yeah, right
I don't
now it's
know.
A magnet. Yeah, right now it's a magnet.
Yeah. Once you give it some sort of controlling mechanism, even if it self-replicates, you can figure out that it's doing it, and either by the heat of the reaction, or by just saying, "My heavens, that's a big zit," the outcome will be sort of obvious. Every medicine has a risk in associated with it. If you look at the ads on TV these days, you know them risks because someone made them tell them to you, along with promises that your condition will go away and you'll be able to have sex or whatever it is. So there's always a risk associated with some reward. Without specifics on this, all I can do is humph and, you know, blather a bit, but I really don't have enough data to say anything specific. Want to talk about advertising on websites? That's been getting a great response in my articles. The ad blocking has gotten probably the more sustained conversations I've seen in a while. It seems to be a hot topic amongst a lot of people.
Well, it seems kind of like medicine, the kind of thing that affects nearly everyone. And I tell you what, why don't we hang on to that and plan to talk about it next time, because I'm afraid we've just about run out of time for this week. our little fishies led us right up to the end of the program. And I, for one day, blame Dave Wagner for that.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
I blame him as well.
It's really awful how I end every program by dominating.
It is. We're gonna have to do something about that. Well, speaking of ending the program, one of the things we do is talk about what's coming up for the next week. And, Larry, let's start with you. What's on your radar screen for the coming week?
Well, I do get to compare a billion users on Facebook per day to one of the signs of an impending biblical-style apocalypse.
Okay. I think that sounds like a fascinating comparison. I'm looking forward to reading that.
With any luck at all, it should show up sometime, if not today, then tomorrow.
All right. And for all of your articles and your other wit and wisdom, where can people find you online in the social media world?
Wherever you're socially needleizing, wherever your Tweety pipes are, Larry Loeb, LARRYLOEB, will get a hold of me.
Well, Larry, we will look forward to doing just that. Thank you so much for being with us today, and we will look forward to next time.
My pleasure, Kurt.
And Dave, now let's turn to you, because I know that you tend to be thinking ahead in terms of the articles you're going to cover and what they mean for the community here at Information Week.
Yeah, Sunday I have an article on Facebook's new digital assistant, M, and what I hope M can do, that is a lighthearted look at M and Facebook.
You mean besides enslave the entire human population?
If it enslaved them, but, you know, put us to good work, I guess I'd be okay with it. I'm not guaranteeing it'll come out this week because we have some scheduling issues, but I've written a slideshow about 10 interesting new Kickstarter technologies that are going to be great for both students and for IT pros for back to school.
Outstanding. And now, in your case, where can people keep up with everything that you're doing online? Where is your social media presence?
Sure. You can find me on Twitter at GeekendDave. That's Geekend with a G instead of a W in weekend. And you can always find me on Information Week, and I also write on allanalytics.com.
Outstanding. Looking forward to following everything you're doing. And speaking of following the editors and contributors to Information Week, one of the editors in our online discussion right now is our own Charlie Babcock, who writes about all kinds of open source and enterprise software topics. I mean, if you want to keep up with enterprise class open source, you really must follow what Charlie writes. And he's going to be at VMworld next week. That's the VMware hoo-ha that happens every year. Everyone is expecting some moderately big news out of that, and I think I have heard some whispers that Charlie's gotten some pre-briefing and will be reporting heavily from VMware's VMworld. So be sure to check back on our site at Information Week to keep up with all the news out of VMworld. Now, as for me, I've got a piece that went up today on one of the tools that I use for podcasting when I'm on the go. It's a hands-on review, so please check that out. And in the coming week, I'm working on a really big story, one that I'm having fun with. I'm looking at the way that data is being used to track, analyze, and wildfires like the ones that have hit so much of the U.S. West this year. I've been talking to some fascinating people, including at least one interview done with someone who was calling me from a tent out on a fire line in Idaho. That's going to be out early next week, both an article and a bunch of images going with that. So I hope that everyone will follow that. To keep up with me online, please follow me at KG4GWA on Twitter, Kurt.Franklin on Instagram, or Curtis Franklin at Facebook or LinkedIn. Well, for all of us here at Information Week Live, I want to say thank you and remind you that next week, next Friday, that will be the first Friday in September, we're going to be on vacation because it is a long weekend here in the United States, and our company typically, in its great beneficence, lets us hang it up a little bit early on the Friday before a three-day weekend. So we will not be with you next Friday, but starting the Friday after that, going on through the fall, every Friday here at 3 p.m. Eastern for Information Week Live. Well, for Larry Loeb, Dave Wagner, and everyone here at Information Week Live, I'm Kurt Franklin saying thanks so much for being with us. Hey, we'll see you online.